Welcome to the Deep Dive. We dig into the sources, pull out the key stuff for you.
Yeah.
Today we're tackling a golf story that's, well, pretty amazing. An unlikely winner. A course known for being just brutal. And it all happened during the Great Depression. We're talking 1935 U.S. Open at Oakmont.
Yeah, and Oakmont in the 30s, it was already legendary for difficulty. You add the Depression backdrop, it really sets the stage for something unexpected, something truly surprising.
Exactly. Our focus is Sam Parks Jr. He was just 25, a club pro from Pittsburgh, right near Oakmont.
Mm-hmm.
And he somehow wins the biggest tournament in the country. We've got articles, notes on Parks, Oakmont's history, tournament details, the whole era. We're going to unpack it.
Right. The goal is to figure out how. How does a local guy, you know, not a big touring star, beat the best players in the world on maybe the hardest course during such a tough time nationally? What can we really learn from this?
We want to find those key insights. And maybe as you listen, think about this. What does it really take for an underdog, an unknown, to win on the absolute hardest stage? So let's start with Sam Parks Jr. Who was this guy? Before 1935, you wouldn't have heard much about him outside Western PA, right?
Pretty much. Born near Pittsburgh Bellevue in 1909, golf was definitely in his blood, though. His dad, Sam Sr., was a skilled player, involved in the local golf association, even a rules authority. So yeah, Sam Jr. grew up around the game.
And he got a pretty special first lesson.
Yeah, this is a great little detail from the sources. His first formal lesson, back in 1922 when he was a teenager, was from Gene Sarazen.
Wow, Sarazen. Learning from the squire right at the start.
Incredible, isn't it? But he didn't just jump straight into being a pro. He took a different path first, one that was pretty unusual for golfers back then.
Okay, what did he do?
He went to college, University of Pittsburgh, which, you know, most aspiring pros didn't do that. He didn't just go. He helped start their golf program, captained the team, and got a business degree. A business degree.
Yeah.
In the 30s.
Mm.
For someone wanting to be a golf pro.
Yeah, exactly. That really makes him stand out. Most guys came up through the caddy ranks at a pro shop.
So did that degree change his plans?
Well, maybe initially, but he did turn pro in 33, and by 35, he was the head professional at South Hills Country Club, another place near Pittsburgh.
And that term club professional, that's really important context for the time, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely crucial. The sources say something like 95% of golf pros then were club pros. They made their living teaching, running the shop, you know, club duties. The whole idea of a full-time touring pro was just starting, really just a handful of guys.
And the Depression must have played a big role in that career path.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. Tough economic times, fewer jobs for college grads, even business grads. Becoming a club pro near home probably felt like a solid, practical choice. Steady income, even if it wasn't huge.
Okay, so he's a club pro. What was his playing record like nationally before the Open? Any wins?
That's the thing. That's the core of this underdog story. Sam Parks Jr. had zero national tour wins before walking onto Oakmont for the 35 Open. He was respected locally, sure, won some regional PGA stuff later on the national scene, basically unknown. So this win really did come out of nowhere for most people.
Okay, so an unknown local pro steps onto the stage. Let's talk about that stage. Oakmont in 1935. What are we dealing with here?
Formidable is an understatement. By the 30s, Oakmont's reputation was already terrifying. The architect, Henry Fownes, wanted a British links feel wide open, no trees back then, hard, fast fairways, and those greens, legendary speed and slope.
But it's built on clay, not sandy links soil, right? That must make a difference.
A huge difference. That clay base meant drainage wasn't great, making the fairways incredibly hard, almost like concrete sometimes. Balls would just bounce unpredictably. You had to play a totally different kind of game.
So what was the setup like for the 35 Open specifically?
It was just a beast. Nearly 7,000 yards, 6,981, I think the source said. Par 72. It had this par 5, the 12th, that was 621 yards long.
621 yards. As a par 5.
Yeah. Apparently, the members usually played it as a par 6. And the bunkers... Oakmont's bunkers are famous now, but back then, they had something extra.
Uh-oh. What was that?
This is where it gets really nasty. 220 bunkers filled with heavy river sand. Okay, that's tough enough, but they were furrowed.
Furrowed. What does that even mean? Like plowed?
Kind of. They used the special heavy rake to deliberately cut grooves into the sand, like little parallel dishes, maybe 2 inches deep, 2 inches apart. If your ball ended up in one of those furrows... forget finesse. It was basically just blast it out and hope for the best.
That sounds absolutely horrible to play out of.
Miserable. And then, just to make it even harder, the weather during the tournament was awful.
Oh, great. What happened?
Heavy rain, severe conditions, made the course play even longer. Greens maybe a bit softer, but still treacherous. And you see it in the scores. Final round. Nobody in the top 20 broke 75. The best score anyone shot that afternoon was a 73.
Right. So Park's winning at 11 over, 299. That sounds high. But in context, it was about survival, wasn't it?
Exactly. It wasn't a birdie fest. It was about avoiding those big numbers, just hanging on.
Okay. Monster course, terrible weather. Who was in the field? Who were the big guns Parks was up against? 159 players, you said.
Yeah, a full field. And it wasn't weak. You had guys like Jimmy Thompson, known for hitting it a mile. He ended up finishing second. But then you had the absolute legends. Walter Hagen was there.
Mr. Major himself.
11 majors to his name. He actually grabbed the lead for a bit in the final round. It turned out to be his last real shot at winning another major.
And Parks' old teacher, Sarazen.
Yep, Gene Sarazen was there too. Yep. Remember, he just won the Masters that spring with the shot heard around the world. He finished tied for sixth. So you have this amazing student versus teacher dynamic playing out.
Any other notable folks?
Sure. Horton Smith, Denny Shute, Paul Runyon, all top players of the day. A guy named Chris Brinka was the low amateur. And an interesting historical note, Kanakichi Nakamura from Japan played, and he became the first Japanese golfer ever to make the cut in a U.S. Open.
Okay, so walk us through the tournament. How did Parks thread the needle?
Well, the first round, everyone struggled. Only one guy, Butch Kruger, broke par with 71. Thompson shot 73. Parks opened with a 77. Not amazing, but solid enough, kept him in touch.
So just kind of hanging around?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Second round, Thompson shot another 73 to take the lead at two over. Parks matched that 73. That was key. It moved him up the board into fourth place at six over, just four shots back. Steady golf while others were maybe pressing too hard.
And then Saturday morning, the third round, that's where things really happened for him.
Yeah, this seems to be the turning point. He shot another 73, his third one in a row. But the big moment, the one the sources really highlight, came on the eighth hole. He chipped in for eagle from 60 feet.
60 feet for eagle on those Oakmont greens.
Can you imagine? Apparently there were like 10,000 people watching. That single shot vaulted him into a tie for the lead, with Thompson heading into the final round Saturday afternoon. Tied at seven over. Huge momentum swing.
Tied for the lead. Local guy. Final round of the Open at Oakmont. The pressure must have been unbelievable. And the weather got worse, you said.
Yeah, the afternoon was rough. Conditions deteriorated. Hagen made that brief charge, took the lead, but then collapsed with four straight bogeys. Thompson couldn't handle it either, shot a 78. But Parks just hung tough. He shot 76. Not a great score in normal circumstances, but on that day, under that pressure, it was incredible resilience, pure grit.
And that 76 did the job.
It did. His total, 299, 11 over par, was good enough to beat Thompson by two shots.
And that 299 total.
Yeah.
There's something important about that number itself.
There really is. Get this. Sam Parks Jr. was the only player in the entire field, all 159 guys, who broke 300 for the 72 holes.
The only one.
The only one. Every single other player, including Hagen, Sarazen, and all of them, shot 300 or more. That tells you everything about how hard Oakmont played and how Parks didn't just win. He survived it better than anyone else.
So it wasn't just luck. There had to be something else going on.
Yeah.
Which brings us to this home course advantage idea. But it sounds like he took it way beyond just being familiar with the place.
That's exactly the insight. Yeah. It wasn't luck. It was preparation. Intense, almost obsessive preparation. Being from Pittsburgh, being a pro nearby, that gave him a baseline, sure, but he went miles beyond that.
What did he actually do?
This is what's amazing. The sources say that for a whole month before the U.S. Open, he played a practice round at Oakmont every single day.
Every day, for a month, while still working his club job.
Yep. Can you imagine that commitment? And it wasn't just playing golf, it was study. He supposedly worked with Oakmont's own pro, Dutch Loeffler. They weren't just hitting shots, they were analyzing the course, breaking it down.
And the note-taking. He really took detailed notes.
Meticulous notes. This is where that business degree might have kicked in, that analytical mindset. He literally charted the greens quadrant by quadrant, wrote down breaks, slopes, how the grain affected putts. He had notes on exactly which club to hit from specific trees or bunkers or dips in the fairway.
He basically wrote his own instruction manual for Oakmont 35.
Pretty much. And that kind of detailed analytical prep was just not common back then. But you see the result, especially on the greens.
What was that putting stat again? It was incredible.
Only 2 3-putts in 72 holes. on Oakmont's notoriously impossible greens under championship pressure, 2-3 putts all week. That is directly tied to knowing those greens inside and out from that intense preparation.
That knowledge must have been like a shield against the pressure, even if he was nervous.
I think so. Parks himself admitted years later he was scared to death down the stretch, which makes him human, right? But knowing exactly what his ball should do, having seen it 100 times in practice, must have given him the confidence to, as he said, hang in. It didn't kid the fear, but it let him manage it.
So the Loken kid, armed with his notebooks, beats the course and the stars. What was the reaction? Must have been huge news.
Oh, massive, especially in Pittsburgh, obviously. Hometown kid wins open. That was the story. And during the Depression, you know, this idea of a regular guy, a club pro, winning through hard work, it really struck a chord. The papers called it a shock, said he had emerged from obscurity.
And there's some nice personal details about him, too.
Yeah, there's this interview in the Pittsburgh Press. Evelyn Burke talked to him. He comes across as really modest, maybe a bit overwhelmed. She asked about girls and fame, and he apparently said something like, "For heaven's sake, don't make me out a ladies man. I've been too busy to bother with girls." Said he liked to dance, but golf took all his time, and honestly, I'm not in love. Just kind of grounding details, you know.
Just a young guy focused on his golf. And he got the trophy from Prescott Bush.
That's right. Prescott Bush, George H.W.'s father, George W.'s grandfather, he was the USGA president then, handed over the trophy. Quite a photo op looking back.
So beyond the headlines, what's the legacy of this win in U.S. Open history?
It stands out as this really inspiring story, you know, the club pro beating the odds through sheer preparation. And that winning score, 299 plus 11, it was the highest winning score since 1927, which was also at Oakmont. Just hammered home how incredibly tough that course was. Par was definitely not the goal there.
And the win got him onto the Ryder Cup team.
It did later that year. And he had another clutch moment there, too. In his singles match, he was playing Alf Perry, who was the reigning British Open champion. Parks made a 30-foot birdie putt on the very last hole to have the match.
A 30-footer on 18 to tie the British Open champ. Wow.
Yeah, pretty dramatic. And apparently that was the first time the current U.S. Open and British Open winners had ever played each other in the Ryder Cup. So another little piece of history.
But maybe the wildest legacy from that 1935 Open wasn't Parks' win itself, but something triggered by how tough the course was, especially the greens.
This is such a cool side story. Okay, so there was this guy watching the tournament, Edward Stimson Sr. He was a good amateur golfer, kind of an inventor type. And he's watching these world-class pros just completely flummoxed by Oakmont's greens. Putting looked impossible. And Stimson realized, these greens are way too fast, and more importantly, there's no standard way to measure how fast.
So seeing the players struggle gave him an idea.
Exactly. The extreme difficulty he witnessed at the 1935 Open directly inspired him to invent a device, the stimp meter.
The stimp meter. The thing they still use today to measure green speed.
That's the one. A simple little ramp, you roll a ball down it, measure how far it goes, it gives an objective number for green speed. It totally changed greenkeeping, how courses are set up, everything. And it happened because Ed Stimson watched the 1935 U.S. Open at Oakmont.
That is incredible. So a direct line from the brutal conditions of that specific tournament to a tool that revolutionized golf course management worldwide. What an unexpected outcome. And we keep mentioning it, but the Great Depression is the constant backdrop here.
Oh.
How is the golf world managing during that economic crisis?
Well, at the club level, it was really tough. The Depression hit recreational golf hard. Sources say club memberships dropped by half in some places, courses closed down. It was a bad time for the everyday golf business. But kind of surprisingly, the pro tournament scene actually seemed to be organizing and maybe even growing a bit.
Yeah.
Guys like Dob Harlow were working to put together a more formal tour schedule, increase prize money. The total purse money apparently went from around $77,000 up to $130,000 during those Depression years. So Parks' $1,000 winner's check.
Yeah.
How did that stack up?
It was a really big deal, especially for a club pro. Just for comparison, the year before, 1934, the guy who won the most money all year, Paul Runyon, earned about $6,700 total. So winning a grand in 1 week was significant money back then. A huge boost, if not his main income. You also started seeing the first hints of corporate sponsorship. Hershey Chocolate sponsored an event, manufacturers' associations. And even though times were tough, people still looked to sports for inspiration, for escape. Municipal courses helped keep the game accessible, too.
It sounds like a real pivot point for professional golf.
Totally. You had the old guard, Hagen and Sarazen, still competing but maybe fading slightly. You had the enduring influence of amateurs like Bobby Jones. You had the current stars like Picard, Shute, Runyon. And just on the horizon were Nelson, Snead, Hogan. Plus, technology was changing. Steel shafts were taking over from hickory.
And Parkswind feels like it sits right in the middle of that transition.
It really does. You could see it as maybe one of the last great hurrahs for the traditional club pro, winning the biggest prize purely on skill and local knowledge before the era of the full-time touring pro completely dominated. It's a reminder that deep, focused preparation for a specific challenge could still conquer all, even without playing tournaments week after week.
So wrapping this up, Sam Parks Jr. at Oakmont in 1935. It's way more than just an upset. It's the story of the local guy, the club pro, not famous naturally, tackling this incredibly difficult course in the depths of the Depression and winning.
And it wasn't a fluke. The sources hammer home the preparation, that month of daily practice rounds, the note-taking, charting greens. That analytical approach, so unusual then, gave him the edge. Especially on those greens, remember, only 2-3 putts all week. That's mind-boggling.
It was a story people needed back then, the hometown hero making good. And then that completely unexpected ripple effect, the invention of the snip meter, born directly out of how punishing Oakmont was that specific week, it literally changed the texture of the game forever.
It really is a testament to preparation, resilience, knowing your environment inside and out, how that can overcome, you know, maybe more raw talent or star power. It shows that mastery of the fundamentals, of the specific task at hand, can sometimes count for more.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How one event, one specific challenge, can have these huge unforeseen consequences down the line. Park showed how intense focus can beat the odds. But maybe the deeper lesson from Oakmont 35 is how facing a truly brutal test can actually force the innovation that changes everything. Makes you wonder, what challenges today might be quietly sparking the next big breakthrough?